Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is time to ask the doctors. Wastewater data in Massachusetts continues to rise. Our case numbers higher, actually, than they were this time last year. Kids ages 5 to 11, they can now get a booster, but kids under 5 still can't get a first shot. Public health officials say the goal no longer to avoid infections, but severe illness and death, as some raise the specter of a person potentially having multiple COVID cases each year. There is a lot to talk about. And you texted us a lot of questions for today, so we're going to jump right in. With us, two infectious disease specialists from Tufts Medical Center. Welcoming back Dr. Helen Boucher. Welcome back, Dr. Boucher.
Thanks so much, Tiziana. Nice to be with you.
And welcoming back Dr. Gabriela Andujar-Vazquez. Welcome back to you as well.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Dr. Andujar-Vazquez, I'll start with you and the state of COVID here. So spring was kind of supposed to be the time. It got warmer and it was going to get a little better. We thought maybe this year we move into the endemic phase of this virus. But now almost all Massachusetts counties are high risk for COVID. The wastewater looks like it did in January, nationally sicker than we were last year. And last year we were just beginning to roll out vaccines. So put it in context. What's going on?
Yeah, I know that this is the fact that the cases are going up and currently and you know, when you compare with other surges that we've had, we were hopeful that this wouldn't happen as precipitously as we're seeing right now. But I think that there's a couple of things that are different and in a good way in this time during this time. You mentioned vaccines, you know, they still are effective and they still are avoiding hospitalizations. And then the other key part is therapeutics. We have now pills that you can take at home if you get COVID. We have other medications that we can give through intravenously. And I think that that has actually changed our hospitalizations. And even with that, also the deaths that we are still not seeing increasing, which is good. So even though we're living through another surge with all the barriers and this discouragement that could sound, and I think that we are in a better position today than we were in previous surges.
So, Dr. Boucher, I'm actually going to pick up on the reference that Dr. Andujar-Vazquez just made to pills for treatment now, and I'm going to go to one of the questions we got in our texting group. This is from Liz from Stoneham. She had several questions, but I'm going to give you this piece. Can you explain what the antivirals are supposed to do if someone who tests positive and is prescribed them, you know, i.e. Paxlovid? I keep reading the patients have, quote unquote, COVID rebound. So who is supposed to get this medication and what are the pros and cons? So confusing. Dr. Boucher.
Yeah, no, great question. So the oral antivirals that Dr. Andujar mentioned include the drug Paxlovid, which is the most effective of the options that we have available. And these medicines are now widely available in our state with multiple ways to get them via telemedicine or in person. So I definitely recommend you call your doctor if you're diagnosed with COVID. Most of the population actually is recommended for medication. There are some contraindications, and that's why it's important to talk to your doctor. But if you get the medicine, it is designed to directly attack the virus and knock down the virus and shorten the duration of your symptoms and the severity of your symptoms. And it's been proven to be 90% effective at keeping people out of the hospital. So that's really good news. It can have some funny taste and maybe some other milder side effects, but it's quite well tolerated. So the second thing you mentioned is this observation of rebound. And there have been some patients who have been treated with Paxlovid who have an initial response. They feel better. They are better. And then maybe a week later, you know, after the symptoms started, they start to have symptoms again. And this has been reported, and nothing, I would say, to be overly concerned about. In fact, viruses do this as well. So we're still teasing out how much of this is related to the medicine versus the virus itself. But all in all, I think it's important to remember that these medicines are 90% effective at keeping you from getting sick enough to go to the hospital with COVID.
All right. Thank you for that, Dr. Boucher. I want to pick up now on a couple of things having to do with reinfection. So I'm going to put a question of mine and a question from a member of our texting group together for you, Dr. Andujar Vasquez. So Sonia in Boston says, are there still concerns over long-term effects of COVID? And what happens if you get COVID twice? Is that dangerous? And I'll pair that with what is the level of threat of reinfection at this point for people who have had COVID already?
Right. A very interesting question. You know, there's a proportion of the population that seems to be, I would say, quote unquote, more susceptible to reinfection than others. You know, we have here about one third of the U.S. population that has never had COVID, or at least they know of. And then we have a big proportion of the population that has had it, and not once, but twice, or sometimes even three times. Or just based on the surveillance data. And so we're still trying to understand what are the risk factors for individuals that get COVID to go into long COVID. There was actually a recent study published just this week about a big group of population. It was in a particular private insurer, so it's not representative of everyone in the U.S., right? But it was a big study where they were looking at trying to understand what risk factors the American citizens have to go into long COVID. It seems that it's more likely to happen in individuals that are middle-aged, and more likely to happen in when you have mild to moderate disease, as opposed to being hospitalized with it, which is very interesting. I think we have a lot to learn on how to, a lot of studies are ongoing on how to address these issues. I don't think that the more you have COVID, like if you have it once, twice, or three times, we're not sure if that increases your chances of getting long COVID. I think that we do have an idea that being vaccinated might help avoiding that. Particularly in younger individuals, which are the highest risk group for long COVID.
So just to summarize a couple of key things there, it sounds like there's a lot we still don't know about long COVID, and also that your risks of long COVID as well as reinfection really might be really based on the individual. We can't necessarily make blanket statements on those things yet.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's correct.
All right. So let me come back to you, Dr. Boucher. One of the other things that's come up a lot is this question about, do we know how many infections we really have? So let me put this in perspective. Last year, 7-day average test positivity rate was hovering about 1%. Now that number is over 9%. But also, we were testing fewer people last year, but when we did test people, it was pretty much getting reported all the time because it was PCR tests in a hospital or clinic kind of environment. And let me clarify, this time last year specifically. Now, there are reports, there was a report in the Boston Globe saying we may be underestimating positivity by as many as 3.5 times because people are home testing. So what do we and don't know about our positivity rates right now? And how concerning is it that they're so much higher than at this time last year?
Yeah, so this is another great question. And you hit on a couple of the key points, Tiziana, right? So a lot is different this year than last year. We have vaccinated people and we have people testing at home. So there are fewer people getting PCR tests, and we know that more of them are symptomatic. So the kind of rate of positivity reflects likely positivity among people who are symptomatic and more likely to have COVID. So certainly we've got more COVID. I think it's, you know, the modelers are doing the work to kind of estimate how much we may be under or over appreciating. The wastewater helps us, and the wastewater gives us a snapshot of what's going on, and that's not a great number, right? It's still not to the levels that we saw with the Omicron surge, but it's still trending in the wrong direction. So we are looking less at cases, and Dr. Andujar mentioned this sort of disconnect that is good, right, that we're seeing in a vaccinated state like Massachusetts, where we have highly vaccinated individuals and a lot of people who've had COVID. There's a disconnect between infections and either hospitalizations or death, which is really good. And that means that the COVID is not causing as much trouble as it has in the past. And that is very reassuring from a public health standpoint.
All right, thanks. I want to now pick up a voicemail question that we received from one of our listeners in our texting group. This is Sean in Brighton, who is a mental health clinician at a local school.
Hi, my name is Sean from Brighton. I work at a high school, and between January and now, a lot of the kids and staff have gotten COVID. I'm wondering what you can say about the mental health effects after an infection, as well as how long it might take for a fully vaccinated person to recover their stamina, and what supports they need, even if they don't have long COVID.
So I was particularly intrigued about the question about mental health effects, especially when it takes a long time to recover, Dr. Andujar-Vasquez. I know when I had COVID at the end of December, beginning of January, the fatigue lasted so long, it wears on you. So what are we having about the mental health effects of having had COVID?
Yeah, great question. And even though mental illness may be outside of my expertise, we do work closely with a lot of our mental health experts around the COVID and related issues like this. You know, at baseline, the pandemic has affected us in many ways that we are yet to even quantify or even describe in terms of mental health. And that on top of getting infected with the virus can also take a toll into individuals, families, loved ones, friends, right? We have learned to live with not only being sick with the COVID and what that may mean for our own health, but also worrying about people we maybe live with, making sure that we did the right thing about getting tested and not exposing individuals. And then it's like the uncertainty of having COVID and then will I be fine? Will I have long COVID like the caller mentioned?
Yeah.
And what to do about that? You know, COVID behaves similarly to other viruses that we do see quite often in the infectious disease world, like, you know, infectious mononucleosis and other herpetic viruses, where people take some time to recover, which is interesting about viruses in general. And so trying to cope with all of that while, going back to some sort of normalcy after trying to, it's hard. And certainly I don't have any particular tips or tricks on how to navigate that. But I think that the one thing I would recommend on people that have had COVID and are struggling with recovery physically and mentally is to speak out, follow with their, physicians and talk about it, right? Be open about it. So we can together navigate those issues that maybe our patients are struggling with and try our best, right, to help make people feel better mentally and anemically.
Thank you for that. So I'm going to go back to our texting group, Dr. Boucher. This one's from Tammy in Rowley. I have a question regarding booster shots for those ages 5 to 11. My soon-to-be 12-year-old received Pfizer in December. Now he is eligible for the booster. Will it be okay for him to get the adult dose of the booster once he turns 12 in June, or should he receive the kid's dose of booster since his original vaccine was the kid's dose? And again, just acknowledging that Pfizer's vaccine was just authorized for boosters for kids ages 5 to 11.
Yeah, so, certainly I'm not a pediatrician, so I would recommend asking the pediatrician. And I think the most important thing is that he gets the booster. If he turns 12, he's eligible for that age 12 dose. And so that's what the package would suggest. But again, I think it's important to ask your child's pediatrician for the right advice for him or her.
And Dr. Boucher, I'll stay with you for a second longer because I can just feel the collective frustration of our listeners whose kids are under 5, right? Saying, so wait, kids 5 to 11 now can get boosted. My kids still can't get vaccinated. So this is my weekly check-in. When do we think that's coming, Dr. Boucher? Any idea?
Yeah, I certainly don't have a crystal ball. And, I know everybody's working hard to make sure that the data are reviewed and of the quality that we need to know that vaccines are safe and effective for small children. The thing I do want to just emphasize is that the data continue to show us, thankfully, that the risk to those small kids is proportionately low, right? The smaller kids don't overall get as sick with COVID. So obviously we want the vaccine to come, but parents should be reassured by those data as well. And kids are back in daycare and school and preschool and all those activities.
Thanks for that. Dr. Andujar Vasquez, Pat and Wayland is going to give us a good chance to review a couple of basics. And we're on a little bit of a tight time frame here, but Pat and Wayland asks, how long is a person supposed to quarantine if they have tested positive? And if you've been exposed but haven't tested positive, is there a quarantine protocol? This is a great time to remind people of what those basics are.
Yes, absolutely. Great time. So in the community, we are expected, if we have COVID infection, to be in isolation for a total of 5 days. And as long as we're fever-free and improving, we're allowed to get out of isolation day 6, but with the assurance that we are going to wear a mask around others for the remaining 5 other days, right? For a total of 10 days. So that what that means is like you're in strict isolation for 5 days, and then day 6 to 10, I'm wearing a mask around others, even at home, to decrease that chance of transmission. Because we know that by day average 6 to 8, we are, by day 6, we are less infectious to others at that point, which is why we are able to get out of isolation by day 6. And in terms of quarantine, if you're exposed, you know you're exposed when we're in close contact with an individual, the recommendation is to wear a mask around others during the between day 1 to day to 10 days total, and monitor for symptoms, right? Making sure that if you have fever, cough, any of those respiratory symptoms, that you go ahead and get tested right away and isolate until you get your test results.
And to clarify, the day you find out you've been exposed, or the day you were exposed, or the day you test positive, that's day 0, right?
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely right. That can be a little confusing when we count. But basically, day 0 is the day that you find out the test is positive, or the day that you started having symptoms. And then we start counting day 1 the next day.
All right. Doctors Gabriela Andujar Vasquez and Helen Boucher are both infectious disease physicians at Tufts Medical Center. They're both also on the faculty of the Tufts University School of Medicine. Want to thank you both for helping us with Ask the Doctors today. Hope to have you back again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Listeners, you heard a lot of great questions and a voicemail from listeners who have joined our texting club. We'd like you to join, too, so you can engage with us about the stories and segments on the show. To do that, text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's 617-766-0382. It's the word Boston. Thanks so much, and we'll be back with more Radio Boston after a break.
Never send a human to do a machine's job.
Do I even need to tell you? Agent Smith, 1999, Hugo Weaving in The Matrix. It is now 2022, and we are not living in a matrix, but thanks to artificial intelligence, computers do have a growing say in how we live our lives and what happens, from big things like a mortgage approval to little things like the personalized ads you see on YouTube. AI is permeating a lot, along with the algorithms that run it. And there's a problem with that. Computers are programmed by humans, and humans have biases. Boston Globe technology columnist Hiawatha Bray wrote recently about two instances of how bias and algorithms or rules behind AI are affecting our lives. He's back with us now for our next installment of Tech Talk. Hiawatha, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Okay, so my eyes cross as soon as I hear the word algorithm. So maybe let's start there and have you explain briefly, what is an algorithm in AI? What even is that?
Well, an algorithm is just a system for doing things. It's a set of step-by-step instructions on how to do a particular thing. And algorithms can be basically honed and improved upon, not just by being deliberately written by humans, but also by using machines that can learn how to improve upon algorithms and figure out more effective and efficient ways of doing certain things.
So you might have some rules, for example, like the rules in a match.com that say, if these people have these characteristics and these people have these characteristics, introduce them to each other. But you're saying also that the machines can begin to improve on and adjust those rules all by themselves.
Yeah, basically, they're learning how. In some cases, it's because they are deliberately taught how to do these things. And in other cases, they can basically respond to the way human beings use them. I think we mentioned that famous case of the woman with a black-sounding name who suddenly was discovered, yeah, she was a professor at Harvard who discovered that whenever somebody punched up her name, they got a lot of ads for bail, not for bail services, it was for background check, criminal background check information. And it turns out that when Google heard somebody with a black-sounding name, it would be more likely to give you an ad for a background check service as if you were being checked out for a criminal background check. Now, in that case, it wasn't because Google had written the software to be prejudiced in any way. It's because the way Google decides what answers to give you are determined by what you ask it. And if people who asked about people with black-sounding names then went on to ask about criminal background checks, Google would learn to associate black-sounding names with criminal background checks. So, and so it would just start giving you more and more and more. And it was never even intended to work that way. But the way humans used the program changed the way the program worked. And that's one example. But I recently wrote about a different kind of a situation that comes up. And that is where you use data to train an AI. So you teach an AI how to look at things by showing it thousands or millions of examples of data collected by human beings. And it learns from all this collected data how it is supposed to do its job. Now, a report was just published in The Lancet that really opened a lot of eyes. Some scientists, including some at Harvard and MIT, were trying to find out why it was that an AI that was supposed to look at medical data like x-rays and CT scans didn't give as accurate a performance when it was looking at black people's x-ray scans as it did when looking at white people's x-ray scans. And so the scientists started asking, is this computer able to tell the difference between black people and white people just by looking at an x-ray? Right. Or a CT scan? And it turns out it can. They don't know how it is able to do it, but they took like 700,000 x-ray scans and CT scans, fed it to an AI, and trained it. And they did tell it, these are white people, black people, etc.
This is to test whether it was happening.
Right, to train the AI. Then they took the test. They took a bunch of x-rays and CT scans where there was no markers, nothing that could possibly tell the computer, this is a black person, this is a white person. They fed them into the AI, and with 90% accuracy, the AI was saying, yeah, this is an x-ray of a black person. This is an x-ray of a white person. This is an x-ray of an Asian. And nobody knows how. Radiologists will tell you you cannot tell by looking at them, but the computer could. And now scientists are sitting there going, how the heck did that computer know this person was black? And they don't know.
And it's a problem because of historic disparities in healthcare along the lines of race?
Yeah, it's all partly a problem because there are some cases in which there actually are medical treatments which are, as they call it, race-normed, where they say there we have reason to believe that people who are black will react differently to a particular test for kidney function, for example, or a particular test for heart function. And so if you automatically are assuming that the person you're looking at is black, the computer could conceivably give you a diagnosis that's going to be different than it would give to a white person, even if in your individual case, that's not the right diagnosis to give. And they're trying, this is not a problem that's arisen yet, but they're worried that it might. And so what they want to do is make sure they understand how a computer knows in advance whether or not you're black, white, et cetera. It ties into a much larger issue with AI in general, not just regarding race. It's called explainability. When a human being reaches a decision, we can ask that person, how did you decide that? How do you know that's true? We don't know how to do that yet with AIs. When an AI decides this is what I ought to do, we can't ask it, how do you know this is the right thing to do in this situation? And so scientists are desperately trying to figure out ways to teach AIs not only to come up with these better algorithms, but to explain how they came to those conclusions. And that's going to be a real challenge.
So the other case example, and in your article, you focus on the solution, which I'll get to in a minute, but I want to start with the case. The other case example you wrote about recently that I thought was really interesting are mortgage approval algorithms, which are based on information from previous mortgage approvals, which we know have been racially biased. We know about redlining, you know, with the book The Color of Law, for example. And so it winds up baked in. Talk about that.
Exactly. Well, no, that was a case where, again, at MIT, there's a professor who was working with a couple of high school kids out in California who, by the way, got admitted to MIT. They haven't decided yet whether they're going to go. And What they came up with was a way of trying to avoid training biases into the AI. They aren't redoing the AI. What they're doing is they're taking the training data and they're saying, we're going to figure out how to tell which pieces of training data are biased. And we're going to find out which pieces of which decisions made decades ago by somebody were prejudiced decisions and which decisions were legitimate decisions. And we're going to pull all the prejudiced decision data out of the AI training package. And then we'll train the AI with this so that it will only learn unbiased information. It will not learn how to be biased in the first place. And they came up with a variety of ways to identify, like, for example, if they would, it's a complicated thing. It's kind of hard to explain in a few words. But they figured out ways to look at a given mortgage decision and alter, for example, the race of the person, but change nothing else. Masking some of the information. And if they got the same consistent yes or no answer, regardless of whether the person was treated as black, white, Hispanic, a woman, etc., that is included in the training data. But if they took the same data and kept getting, we'll give this person a mortgage if he's white, but he won't give this person a mortgage if he's black, that entire piece of data is kicked out of the database and it's not used to train the AI. And they're thinking that by using this method, they can teach AIs without injecting human biases. Time will tell whether this works, but this too has been written up in a peer-reviewed journal, and it looks like it has a lot of promise. The scientist who worked on it is trying to see if it can be applied to health data as well so that they can find a way to keep this from happening with AIs that are used for medical treatment. And that's a crucial, important point to remember. As you pointed out at the beginning of this, we are not yet fully taking this on board, but AIs are being used to make all kinds of decisions that directly affect the way our lives. I mean, like, in some cases, there are cases where they're being used in the criminal justice system to decide whether or not somebody will get parole or decide whether or not somebody will get probation.
System is deciding that instead of a person.
No. It's not just, you know, they still have human beings doing input, but they are getting advice from AIs who say, based on our analysis of this person and similar people just like it, you probably wouldn't want to give this person bail or you might not want to give this person probation. And there have been cases in which, I forget the name of it, but there is a very famous case, ProPublica wrote about, where they discovered that there was good reason to believe that there were some racial biases embedded in one of these programs. And we should, what I'm concerned about isn't that these programs are all prejudiced or biased, it's that we're rushing to use them so fast. People are so enamored of artificial intelligence that we are constantly looking at new ways to apply it before we fully understand that we don't know how these algorithms are deciding what to do, and we don't know whether the way we've trained them have built-in biases. So it's going to be a problem.
So, you know, the kinds of solutions that you talked about there, the MIT professor working with the two high school students, and by the way, I'm chuckling at they haven't decided if they'll go yet or not. I mean, those are some students with some great options.
Exactly.
They're on the fence with that. Are you optimistic that these are beginning to or will be able to be deployed to correct for some biases that may be in AI rules that are already out there affecting people's
lives? You know, it's going to be a never-ending issue. I don't want to make it sound like this is some terrifying, nightmarish prospect. This is just another reflection of human existence here. We're always going to have human biases. And just moving it one step forward in putting it inside a machine is a real problem. But at least we're thinking about this now. We're starting to address it, which is cause for optimism. I don't think we talked about this, but I was just reading about this thing that Google is doing, you know, how they are working on figuring out bias in the way we perceive skin tones.
Yes.
And they have come up with a really nice new service that is supposed to make it possible, and it's probably going to end up helping things like designing cameras, like designing facial recognition systems.
Yes, it's a new scale of 10 shades of skin tone as opposed to the previous 6 shades.
Right.
And it's based on work from a dermatologist.
Exactly. And they're trying to figure out ways so that machines and people can perceive skin tone more accurately, which can do things like helping more accurate identification, more accurate photography. The point is that people are thinking about this now. And I can't help thinking that eventually we're going to solve some of these problems, but we'll never solve them completely, not just because of the technology, but because we're human and we're always going to bring our biases to everything we do.
All right, before we let you go for this week's Tech Talk, we've got about a minute left, and you've got a novel Yes. And I want to hear about it.
Well, it's called Power in the Blood, and it's got nothing to do with this. It's got to do with me. Well, it's got something to do with me, I guess, to the extent that I also wrote about another person who's a technology journalist, and he's also a deacon in a church, and somebody nearly gets murdered in his church, and he's trying to find out why, and it turns out it's because this person is involved in a rather startling international conspiracy that could bring down the entire banking system, and I had a lot of fun with it. But it's intended to be a novel. It's about religion, it's about technology, and it's about a person who is trying to deal with the fact that he's a heartless, cruel person who doesn't want to be and is trying to learn to be better.
A better guy.
He's trying to learn to be a better person, and he finds out the hard way that when you're involved with violent, dangerous people, this is not always possible.
Imagine
so I had a lot
that.
Of fun with it.
What made you decide to write a novel?
Because I just wanted to see if I could do it, and it turns out that I could. You know, I didn't write it as fast as I should have, but it finally came out, and I think it's halfway decent. And I'm planning on a sequel already that is going to get even more exciting, I hope. But I don't want to, you know, turn this into...
No, this is fun. Tell us the name of the novel one more time.
Power in the Blood.
All right.
And it's on Amazon. You can find it, and my name will be next to it, and even a halfway decent-looking picture of me, so you can see what I look like.
All right. And can we expect some of those themes to show up in future columns as well for you?
I hope not, because I try to keep those two things
kind of
separate.
You try to keep them separate. All right. Hiawatha Bray is our technology and business reporter with the Boston Globe and our Tech Talk expert. We'll see you in 2 weeks for another round of Tech Talk.
Okay.
Thanks, Hiawatha.
Thank you.
Today, another sneak peek from our WBUR City Space series called Phenomenal Women. The series features in-depth conversations with women who have broken through as leaders in fields historically dominated by men. From scientists to athletes, journalists to artists, we will highlight women who have risen to the top of their fields and ask them about their journeys, how they became who they are today, what it took to break through and blaze new trails, and the advice they'd give to other women who are hoping to shatter ceilings. Last month, we talked to Katie Ray, CEO and managing partner of The Engine, a venture capital program built and spun out by MIT. This month, we spoke with two rock stars from the world of biotech, Dr. Pardis Sabeti, who heads her own lab, mapping the genome to discover new cures for diseases, and Dr. Eva Brennan, president and CEO of Synlogic Incorporated, which is a clinical stage company that creates transformative medicines. And I have to say, after talking with them for an hour, these are two truly phenomenal women. Today, we're bringing you a couple of the highlights from that conversation, and we start with a question I asked both of them. Thinking back, however long ago it might be, what was the first time you remember breaking a glass ceiling or defying an expectation of what girls can and can't do? Dr. Brennan weighed in first.
So I've been reflecting on this a lot recently, and I think that most of my insights about myself have come in hearing myself reflected on someone else. If you know, somebody tries to put me in a box and I react to that by saying, hold on a second, you've got me wrong. And the first time that happened was in high school when, I grew up in Ireland. I went to a high school, a Catholic girls high school, very traditional. You know, we did home economics, not a huge focus on the sciences. And when I went to my career guidance counselor, and, you know, we were exploring what I might like to do. And she thought, well, you know, you're going to want to get married soon and have a family. You know, I think a job where you can have the summers off, like teaching, could be a really good fit for you. And I'm like, hold on a sec. You know, this is not me. You haven't listened to what I like to do. You don't know anything about me. And just had a really negative reaction. But I knew enough to not push back and to just nod and agree in the moment. But I think it actually triggered something in me to push back against that definition or that box that I was, you know, being conveniently placed into, and actually forced me to really think about myself and what it was I wanted to do. And I think that was the first time I realized, well, you know, not all adults know what's best for you. Not all adults give good advice. Not everyone will give you. She was very well-intentioned, but, and I didn't necessarily have an obligation to follow it. So I think that was the first kind of career rebellion, if you will, growing up, and really pushed me to work harder, to, you know, be more ambitious. So maybe had the opposite to effect in terms of what she was thinking of me. So I think that's the earliest example I can think of in looking back over my my life to date.
How about you, Pardis?
I just thought of two examples. It's funny because it's not necessarily in like my job or my career where I felt that kind of like girls don't do that kind of feeling. I mean, obviously you come across it in many ways in your life more insidiously as you get in life and work. The funny thing is, I would say, like, I have two really like clear memories of just one day. I was like in sixth or seventh grade, and the boys would always play football like during lunch. And, you know, one day somebody invited me to play or something, and I went and I played, and I remember I fell in love with it. Like, I loved it so much. I was like, oh my God, I want to do this every single day. And I just like came out and I was so excited. And I just had, it's like literally like the light turned on, and it was like the funnest experience I ever had. And I remember going off and having the cool, I was very uncool, and the cool girls like wanting to talk to me. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like, hi. And they're like, yeah, what are you doing? And I was like, oh my God, I'm playing football. It's like so fun. You guys should come play. And they're like, no, like girls don't do that. And they're just like so disgusted with me. They're just like, girls don't do that. I mean, this, I don't know if it's going to give away something about me, but then later I love concerts, and the same thing happened where I went to a concert and I like the mosh pit. I used to like the mosh pit, and I was in the mosh pit, and I was like having this, this is so fun. Like, we're all just banging against each other. It's really fun. And I came out, and one of the popular girls was like, what are you doing? Like, what are you even doing? And I was like, it's so fun. You got to try this. And it's interesting to me, like the two experiences I have are other women telling me what I was and was not allowed to be doing. And I was like a painfully oblivious person, which is why I was quite unpopular. I was like unpopular, like all the popular boys liked me in math class, but then like made fun of me outside of math class. And it was like, I was that kind of a weird kid that was popular in classrooms and very popular at the lunchroom. I think, you do realize like how much we all self-censor behaviors and tell each other what not to do. And that's actually been, I mean, in a lot of my life, I think a lot of that is, you know, it's so interesting who's holding you back, and it's not always the people you expect.
Aoife, nodding, chuckling there. So let me let you just pick up on that.
I'm thinking maybe that's why she ended up in academic medicine, the love of the mosh pit. that was mine.
Like, gotta be a masochist a little bit. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. No, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's something that we all need to be super conscious of, that we don't inadvertently, you know, box somebody else in or inadvertently give those cues. I think we're all kind of mature enough now to not kind of give somebody that's not something girls do, feedback overtly. But I do think there's probably a lot of signals we give off to girls, to, you know, people starting out in their career journey who are maybe looking for reassurance from more established leaders. And I think it's something just that we have to be super conscious about, right? That we don't give off the girls don't do that signal to others coming up through the ranks. So I think I was, really reflecting on that feedback and those experiences you had, Pardis.
So Pardis, we had an audience member who just wants to know what the concert was. Who was the band?
I'm pretty sure I think it was Ice-T and the Body Count.
The Body Count.
Yeah, I think it was, yeah. Or like Ministry, something ridiculous, but yeah.
All right, we got to stay in that space. Aoife, first concert you remember going to?
Sister sent me a picture recently. I went to Guns N' Roses in 1992, maybe. And I was, of course, in love with Axl Rose at the time. And I remember being right up front, Pardis, and in the mosh pit. It was an absolutely nice, fabulous day. So that was my first concert experience.
I think this is a thread in these discussions I had not expected to pick up on, but will be in the future for sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's a good way to kick it off. So I mean, that was not my first concert. That was my first concert. I didn't immediately walk in and start moshing in my first concert ever. But it was the first concert I think I like got into the mosh pit in.
And that is exactly why these live conversations are so fun. You never know where they're going to go. One question I ask every phenomenal woman is, do you see yourself as a leader who happens to be a woman or a woman leader? Doctors Pardis Sabeti and Aoife Brennan, these two women on top in Boston's biotech world, brought their own lived experiences to the answers. Dr. Sabeti went first.
I don't know if I have that kind of resolution. Like, I don't know if I would say that I know the answer to that question. So this might be a very short line with me. I don't know. I mean, I think I would say that the older, other than those kinds of examples of sort of signals, those cues that you get in middle school, that was rough. Like, going through my professional life, I actually didn't ever feel as if I was a woman, or like, I didn't have that sense. Yeah. And like I said, in the classroom, like that, like all through life, it's like in the classroom, everything was different. Like in the classroom, I was respected and appreciated. And even like, you know, people were really nice to me. Like there's actually this kind of funny thing where it's like in the classroom, they're always like super duper nice to me and everyone was really fun. And so it was like, in that way, like in my professional life, I've never thought like man or woman. People just sort of like took it at face value. And only in the last few years, like as you get older and older, like graduate school was probably the first time I started to sense I was a woman. And just by way, the way we were treated and how stark it was, like this was Oxford circa like late 1990s. It was just a very, very gendered place. And you were reminded on a regular basis that you were a woman doing science. So I think that kind of is where it started. And probably over time, you're reminded enough times in many different ways that you are a woman doing this. And I would say like, as I get older, like it gets more ridiculous and frustrating. And so I think there's a certain point where you say, okay, you know what? Like I am a woman. I'm going to embrace that. I guess I never really, I'm not somebody who really thinks about gender in my like life and, you know, and appreciate, you know, gender fluidity, gender, like gender, you know, I just don't really think about it. Like, I don't know. I'm not thinking I'm in a room with women or I'm in a room with men. I'm just, it's not the way I sort of see things. So it's never been something that's on my mind. And mostly probably, and also like having been so much of my life, like for whatever reason, every like advanced math track I was in, I was oftentimes the sole woman in a room full of boys that I just did. I like lost the perspective of what my gender was. Anyway, but also say like in the last decades, particularly like as a faculty, you're just reminded so often that you're a woman and that you finally like embrace it. And so I would probably say the answer to that question is it's changed. Before I was just a person in science who happened to be a woman. And now I'm like, no, I'm a woman doing science but I'd like to get back to the place, I think, where I'm just a person doing science who happens to be a woman. We're just not there yet. Until we're not there yet, we actually need some people to stand up and say, to sort of speak for us. So I think that's what I try to do where I can.
And how about you, Aoife?
Yeah, I mean, I like Pardis, I really want to get to the place where gender is not a qualifier for leadership, or gender is not a qualifier for, you know, whatever role you're playing professionally. But I'm torn because in order to break through to that place where, you know, it's irrelevant, you know, your gender identity is irrelevant to, you know, your profession and what you're achieving professionally, we have to go through a place where we break the biases about, you know, what does a leader look like? What does a chairman, what does the CEO look like? What does an MIT professor look like? And the only way we get to that place is through representation. So while I really want to get to a place where it's irrelevant, I do realize that there's going to be a sequence of things we have to go through to make sure that there is gender representation on panels, that we don't have mammals, that we're seeing awards are being awarded to, you know, mixed genders and races and everything else, because representation is so important to breaking those biases. And we all have them, you know, we all have these ingrained ideas and they come out. Sometimes I'm disgusted at myself because you catch yourself doing it. You're like, oh my goodness, that's, you know, my deep subconscious making that connection of, you know, what that phenotype is, you know, that's suitable for chairman or that's suitable for CEO or suitable for CFO or whatever role it is. So, you know, it's a very complex issue and I think it's challenging and it's a long-term dream. We get to the irrelevant place. But in the meantime, the only way we'll get there is by making it relevant and so that we make sure that we have that representation to break down those biases that we all have just kind of because of our upbringing and the social cues that are all around us. You know, I think it's going to take some time.
Go ahead, Pardis. I saw you wanting to add in.
Oh, yeah. You know, I started to and then I was like, man, no, I'll hold back because it's great. Everything you're saying, I'm totally on board. Although the one counterpoint I will say to that is, you know, it's true. Like we obviously want to be there and be representing and be available so other people can see like this is what it is, but also have to be true to what it is. Like I have found like, you know, the number of times I've been asked to be on panels where every person on that panel has been awarded something except for me and the other women is exhausting. It's so exhausting. It's like, here's all the people we funded And we gave you a baby grant just to like, you know, kiddo, you got some potential. And there you are, either a guest speaker or a seedling grant, because that's just the way they see you. So at one point when I kind of have my, I have like a little, every once in a while I have my, like, if I had a fake Twitter, what it would say. And I think one of the lines I came up with is, if you're on a panel and you're the only person on that stage that hasn't been supported by the organizer, it's not representation, it's exploitation, like get out of there. And I do feel like that happens all the time where they're like, we just want to see you. We want to see you. And I remember at some point I told one very, you know, big foundation, I was like, you know, I'm not an outbreak entertainer, right? You understand that I actually have like work I do, but they just always want to see you there and they want to showcase you. And to me, I'm like, you know what, be honest about it. Like, you got all men, you feel like that all men are going to do this, then just showcase those men and get me. And I have to go back and do my own work and raise my own funds. So good luck with that. Like, I actually want to be a little bit mindful that we don't do the kind of tokenism, feel good stuff that actually ends up burdening women more, because they're asked to be on every single panel because they have to make it look like we have representation. We don't. So anyway, that's all to say, like, very different. And as I'm saying that, like, very different from this kind of an event where it's like, we are talking about the real stuff, but it's so often in these kind of other types of meetings, they just grab you to like make it look like they're doing a good job. But when you look under the hood, it's really kind of rough. So
Aoife. Yeah, no, I'm just thinking back to an episode early on in my career. I stepped into being CEO of my current company. I was the chief medical officer and was promoted. And one of my first calls was with one of our big shareholders who spent the first 15 minutes telling me how excited they were. They hadn't had a portfolio company with a CEO who's female. They were so thrilled. They were going to put me up on their website straight away, blah, blah. And then at the end of the call, oh, by the way, I'm also just letting you know that we're exiting our position in your stock. Like, do you not know how this world works? You know, it was this gushing, you know, and how thrilled they were and how it was great. They'd been searching to have a female leader of a portfolio company. And I was on their website for probably, you know, a couple of years after they had completely exited their position. And it was just kind of this disconnect, like you're speaking to, Pardis, of like, it's not necessarily quantity and we can't have bean counting. It has to be also an element of quality to really get there, so that it doesn't become just to check the box and you almost have two tiers, because that's, you know, we would all die if something like that happened. But yeah, certainly something that you encounter for sure.
That was Dr. Aoife Brennan, president and CEO of Synlogic Incorporated, a clinical stage company creating transformative medicines, and Dr. Pardis Sabeti, who heads her own lab, mapping the genome to discover new cures for diseases. They joined me in conversation as part of the WBUR City Space series, Phenomenal Women. And we'll bring you a fuller look at that conversation in a special Memorial Day show, so stay tuned for that. You can find out more about the series on our website, radioboston.org. And next month, dancer and choreographer Michelle Dorrance, founder and artistic director of Dorrance Dance and a MacArthur Fellow. You will not want to miss it. We love hearing from you, really enjoying those of you who are in the text group giving us your feedback on segments. We love bringing your questions to air like we did both with a text and voicemail today, letting you know what's coming next. It's a conversation and we really want you to be a part of it. So if you haven't joined our text group yet, I'm asking you, please do. You can text the word BOSTON to 617-766-0382. Again, BOSTON to 617-766-0382. You'll get started with us, learn how to submit text, learn how to submit voicemails, and stay in the mix with us as we carry forward on Radio Boston. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles, with Francisca Monahan and Sarah Leeson. We had help today from Maya Schwader. Marquise Neal, he's our technical director. Karen Schiffman is our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.